perhaps I can start off. In one of your first slides, you showed that measuring 24 urine sampling isn't useful anymore. That we should perhaps use another marker for sodium loading. What do you suggest? Do we have to measure 7 days, or do we have to need to do skin biopsies? Or
well, the question is what question you have, right? So. You can, if you really want to know how much a human being is eating at the moment you see him, if you do three, so the predictive value of a single 24 hours urine sample is 50%, and of three repetitive, then you have half of the 7 day rhythm, is I think it was 76%, and seven measurements was 96%. That is because you simply eliminate the rhythm. Now, the question is, why do you want to know 24 hours urine excretion of salt, right? Now, if you do cardiovascular research, and this has been, I mean, Lifford Vogt has just published that. So he, what he did is that he went into the data, one 24 hours urine sample and cardiovascular outcome decades later, and he found not much. Mm-hmm. But in Holland, they do it very carefully, and there were three and five repetitive samples, and then he did this thing again, and suddenly the outcome was totally different. The study was totally different when he did three or five. That is a circulation paper, 2017. So it is doable. But still, the question then is, you know, if you just think of the time course, if you are collecting urine for 1 week, mm-hmm. and then cardiovascular outcome is measured 20, 30 years later. Mm-hmm. I mean, you run in the same problem because you simply do not know what has happened in these 30, 40 years in between. And that's a major problem in epidemiology. It's just a methodological problem. And that is why we said we do not rely on the black box approach, mm-hmm. and we instead measure tissue sodium content directly. Mm-hmm. And I think it seems to be very cost efficient. I mean, if you compare 130,000 24 hours urine sample, no relationship to mm-hmm. left ventricular mass, and 99 sodium MRIs, and you suddenly have the steep correlation between tissue sodium content and left ventricular mass. I think the 99 sodium MRIs were cheaper mm-hmm. than the 130,000 urine samples. So I think this is a question of precision medicine mm-hmm. if you go into a population.
Can I ask you something? We have a common experience of young ladies coming to the office with the sensation of tension in the tissues. Yeah. They speak about water retention.
Cyclic edema. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Although sometimes you are unable to detect the edema. Mm-hmm. It's just a feeling that they have, and they are really, mm-hmm. really painful, and mm-hmm. it's enormous discomfort for them. Now, I assume that this is, and we have discussed this several times, it is actually sodium trapping in mm-hmm. the derma and mm-hmm. in the skin. Mm-hmm. But how can we get rid of that? Mm-hmm. This is the practical question.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, first question is, if you detect pitting edema, we always think this is water sitting, and we would always believe that this is isotonic. What we find now that in edema is that you always have very high salt concentration, and the reason that this might be hurtful might be that you're activating the immune system, right? So now the question, how do you get rid of it? I mean, that's the 1 million question. We know that 4 hours of dialysis remove tissue sodium content in skeletal muscle, not that much in skin. We know that if you block mineralocorticoid receptor, you get rid of tissue sodium reservoirs. We now know that SGLT2 inhibitors mobilize it. So
is a diuretic approach...
A diuretic approach?
Not chronic, but acute, wise.
So I think there is a mess. So what we do not understand is the chronic effect of diuretics.
Right.
Just to make that point. You take one tablet of furosemide, you pee 4 liters, you do the same thing for 4 weeks, and you do not pee anymore. So the question, of course, is which are the osmolites that are sitting in the renal medulla? Is it potassium? We believe it is urea, but these studies need to be done, right? So acute and chronic is a question. We have the impression that tissues make the decision whether sodium is accumulated or not, and that with drugs like spironolactone, where you really trap the mineralocorticoid receptor at the tissue level, you will be more successful. Because in the end, you have to do two things. You have to excrete the sodium. This is a renal thing, and the drugs, diuretics, will work there. At the same time, you will have to mobilize sodium at the tissue level. And one last comment there is in Erlangen, they're doing at the moment a study where they measure tissue sodium content after transplantation. And it's almost unbelievable how much sodium they release in the first days after transplantation. Now, everybody would say this is the working kidney, and I'm not that sure, because what you're doing is you have them under massive immunosuppression. And we know that the immune system actually traps sodium into the interstitium, and it might well be that blocking the immune system might be a very, very good strategy to mobilize tissue sodium. But that's future.
That's very interesting.
Okay, we take a question. Dr. Tichuan.
Yeah. Thanks so much for both wonderful, wonderful lecture. I learned so much. Just one comment about nephrologists is on board for the sodium storage story. We are very much on board. But as a nephrologist, I also like to ask you about, so same as your papers, as well as your talk, one thing that was not mentioned is after heavy sodium intake, there is 1 or 2 milliosm increase in serum osmolality. Mm-hmm. And that's almost translate to 4 milliosm per kilo of osmolality. Mm-hmm. And plenty of force to stimulate the AVP. Mm-hmm. And the AVP stimulation mm-hmm. is known to cause protein catabolism, mm-hmm. as well as increase renin angiotensin system, mm-hmm. as well as increasing intraglomerular pressure. Mm-hmm. So many of the readouts on your paper, which is excellent, outstanding ones, couples together with if you just put the vasopressin in the picture.
Yes.
And I thought you, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that is, thank you for that. I think that's a very relevant one. Indeed, for example, in renal failure, we find activation of the renin angiotensin aldosterone system. We find high vasopressin. And all that is known, and all that makes perfectly sense. The reason that we did not dwell on it and that I did not show, we simply ask a little bit of a different question here. Because with vasopressin, of course, you're opening the water channel, and then the water would flow. That is beyond the question. The research that we were focusing on was a little bit more quantitative on the barrier side. Because you can open the water channel, but if you do not have the osmolite there to bring the water back, the water will simply not flow. And this is why we had a little bit more focus on the osmolite changes and on the production of osmolites in our current system. But as you say, water conservation, and in the end this is estivation, and the funny thing is that this is exactly what Homer Smith described in 1950, the lungfish. What I have described here is everything that the lungfish is doing. Lungfish is sitting in a hypertonic environment, does not want to dehydrate in the water, breaks down muscle mass, and uses the urea to conserve the water matrix. And of course, this involves vasopressin, because then you need to open the water channel that the water can flow through the osmolite. This also involves the renin angiotensin aldosterone system. It involves sympathetic nerve activity and much, 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 much more. There's much more there. One last thing about the renin angiotensin system. We will study that together with hepatology now, because I never understood secondary hyperaldosteronism in hepatic failure. And if you now say, okay, it is a yin and yang under the barriers, sodium versus urea, what you find in the secondary hyperaldosteronism in liver failure is very high glucocorticoid levels, muscle wasting. This makes sense because your body tries to shuttle every nitrogen to the liver to produce the urea that you desperately need, but the liver does not do it. And then, of course, because you have to maintain your barriers, you will play the aldosterone card. Then if you do not have the urea because you do not produce it, you bring in the sodium. And to our understanding, that's the secondary hyperaldosteronism. And I'm 100% sure that there's a vasopressin response in that as well. But we are a little bit more on the osmolite side. But it's an excellent question, of course.
Okay, please, thank
you. My question is for Professor Tietze. How do you reconcile your findings with the Edelman equation, which suggests that exchangeable sodium, or the osmotically active sodium, is a surrogate marker for total body sodium?
Okay, so again, it's a question of time, right? Edelman focused on blood osmolites, right? So what has been done, he injected sodium 24 or sodium 22, I think it was sodium 24, and he did the Edelman equation. And I never questioned that you are using sodium and potassium to control plasma osmolality. But there's a whole osmolite metabolism that goes totally beyond plasma osmolality. And I did not show you here an example of a patient with hyponatremia, which would now give you insights to the Edelman equation, because we can follow that up too with sodium MRI. We had a patient with hypernatremia, and he had brain surgery, and he simply would not take his replacement therapy. And he had plasma sodium levels, that is published, he had plasma sodium levels of 170, 175, and he would talk to us, and we, of course, were very interested. So we calculated the relative water loss and all those things, gave him free water. The water deficit was something, the calculated water deficit was something like 8 liters. Of course, we infused the water, and we would not see any change in body weight while we corrected his plasma sodium. So what really happened was that all the sodium was sitting inside skeletal muscle, was acutely mobilized in line with the Edelman equation by correcting the secondary hyperaldosteronism that he had due to the initial dehydration. So long story short, for plasma osmolites, the Edelman equation might work on the short term. Long-term regulation of salt and water metabolism is totally different. Adding to the Edelman equation, that's also in the paper, and I could not show it there, we now start to understand that that liver, for example, is heavily involved in plasma osmolite regulation. If you look into that and see how the body really maintains osmolality, you sometimes do not see any changes in plasma sodium concentration, but massive changes in plasma urea concentration. These changes are 45% dependent on the liver, 20% dependent on the kidney, and 20% dependent on skeletal muscle function. So, long story short, the Edelman equation, short-term adaptation to plasma sodium content, that is still correct. The plasma space is 5 liters on the long-term. Plasma sodium concentration is also regulated by sodium stores. This has been done in experimental animals in the 70s and 80s, simply completely neglected by the community. Long-term osmoregulation and short-term osmoregulation, which is correctly predicted by the short-term experiments done by Edelman, are two different things.
But urea can increase when you try to excrete more sodium because of the co-transport mechanism at the tubular level. For example, in heart disease patients,
yes,
it's quite typical when you administer a diuretic and you try to increase natriuresis, they mm-hmm. have a rise in urea.
Yes. So what we did I simply didn't have enough time. These are quite some papers and topics, and I mean, that would be now a whole hour talk only about the natriuretic urethritic concept. The question here is it transporter by the kidney or is it production by the liver? So what you can do is you can also study the relationship between arginase activity, so that enzyme activity, the urea production. And what we find is that liver arginase activity is a better predictor of plasma urea concentration than the transporter expression in the kidney. But that does not mean that liver is better than kidney or kidney is better. All this makes no sense. It's just a hepatorenal regulation. And whenever the kidney has a problem, liver will help. And whenever liver has a problem, kidney will help. And what also will help is mouth. This is why salt makes you hungry, because you're bringing in the protein. And if you do not bring in the protein because you restrict their protein intake, they will take it from muscle. And that's the muscle wasting that we see in our renal patients.
And when you bring the protein, you increase the glomerular filtration rate.
Yes, and I think exactly. And this is now... Wait a second. Then they will live.
He's taking the distance from the...
Yeah, I just want to survive the next sentence. And they and they will live much better with lower GFR because you're supporting the renal concentration mechanism, and
absolutely.
Thereby that's the idea.
Baseline.
Coming back.
Baseline. Okay.
So, of course, without GFR there is no concentration mechanism. But I think, Claudia, the problem that we really have is measurement. Because we cannot measure this damned renal concentration mechanism.
I know.
You have the GFR, that works well, right? But how water is conserved is simply unknown. And if you ask renal physiologists working on the renal concentration mechanism, they do not know exactly know how it works, simply because the dilution methods that we have established in nephrology fail. Because, again, dilution is equilibrium theory, and here you are concentrating, you are separating the direction of osmolite and water, and this is why it cannot work.
Okay, you see some cards, Claudio, for you.
I have a question that says, once you know that the patient has a normal serum creatinine and a reduced renal functional reserve, what do you do? Well, one of the things we have tried to push is to have a post-AKI clinic. In other words, patients who are discharged from the ICU with a normal serum creatinine but had a AKI episode, I think they should be seen by a nephrologist maybe 3 to 4 months later. I know that this may increase the burden of our activity, but remember, when we began seeing the patient with the CKD stage 1 and 2, everybody said, oh, this is too early. But this had an enormous impact on the follow-up and the slowing the progression of chronic kidney disease. So I personally think that we should consider AKI as a doorway for chronic kidney disease. And even though you have seen creatinine goes back to normal, doesn't mean that we have not lost a significant amount of nephrons. The second question is about the importance or the danger of delivering total parenteral nutrition in a patient with AKI in intensive care that may contribute to stress the kidney. Well, this is an important question that is not only dealing with total parenteral nutrition. Is whatever we do in intensive care, we should not just think, okay, the kidney is failing, forget about the kidney. Remember that fresh ischemic lesions have been found in autoptic demonstrations even 1 month after the original episode of AKI, showing that AKI is not one single shot episode. It may have repeated insults in the kidney, and we should prevent the repeated insults and stress in the kidney to promote recovery. Of course, the concept of recovery and injury has to deal with the balance between susceptibility of the kidney and intensity of the exposure. I think that we have to try to improve our practice, avoiding any type of additional injury to this patient who are trying to recover their renal function.
Okay, please.
So this is for Dr. Tietze. I've never been quite clear, I guess, from the details of the relationship between the sodium in the tissue and the blood pressure and how that's regulated. So you showed the description of the Tony BP that activates the VEGF-3, that's the lymphogenesis, and then VEGF-2, I guess, R2 was in the blood vessel. You showed that diagram that you got ENOS over there as well. So can you just describe a little bit more of the details of the, is the blood pressure related to the VEGF, so you increase capillarization, or is it the ENOS, and what's the relationship between those?
So this is now detailed, right? We, of course, asked this question in the paper that has been published. So we block VEGFR3 alone, which is the lymphatics. In this case, you have a lot of VEGFC in the skin that all binds to VEGFR2, and you have a lot of ENOS activity in blood vessels, right? If this is the mechanism to lower blood pressure, then you would expect no blood pressure increase with the blockade, with the VEGFC blockade, VEGFR3 blockade. So we blocked VEGFR3, and the vessels produced and expressed ENOS like hell, and blood pressure went up. That tells us that the blood pressure regulation really lies in the lymphatics, right? So mechanistically, it's not VEGFR2, it is VEGFR3. But we do not know, as nobody knows, this is the so-called autoregulation. Until now, we never knew why blood pressure goes up. Now with the water conservation principle, that suddenly sheds new light into it, because you can now understand the skin as a kidney-like barrier that is there to conserve water, as the kidney is there to conserve water, because otherwise you would pee 180 liters per day. So whenever you have a leaky skin, and this is what's happening with age, you would play the osmolite card to reduce water loss through the skin. But what you also would do, and this is now a hypothesis that we are following up at the moment, you, of course, would reduce blood flow, because the less blood you bring into the barrier, the less you... And this seems to happen, and this seems to be regulated at all levels, at the vasopressin level, at the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone level, which is sitting in there. Interestingly enough, the keratinocyte also regulates blood flow versus HIF-1, HIF-2. And as I have shown you, the NO system. So in the end, it seems to be a body pattern designed for water conservation that relies on many, many, many mechanisms, also on the sympathetic nerve system, simply because this is so important, and on a reprioritization, additionally, of energy metabolism, which then results in arginine depletion and preferential arginine movement into urea and not into NO. And this might also explain why arginine supplementation may not work. Because if your enzymatic machinery switches off NOS for water conservation and prefers urea, then all the arginine will simply flow into urea and you will end up with a vasoconstriction. Now, last point, is this then vascular dysfunction? We discussed that in the lab. No, it's not. It's normal physiological regulation. So the nice thing here is that this is unpublished stuff. I'm glad that you like that. Perhaps we get it published faster this time. Usually it takes 2 years to get a paper through, but that's just as a side. But the nice thing is that this suddenly now is really a unifying hypothesis that might work and is testable for the community at large.
Your hypothesis of the immunoactivation.
Yes.
Isn't not in contrast with the fact that when we have these patients, sometimes we give corticosteroids, mm-hmm. and indeed they tend to accumulate salt and water.
Mm-hmm. So this is a very interesting one now again, because the question is what do these immune cells do really? And I could not go into detail there too, because you all automatically think that these immune cells are trimmed to kill bacteria, fungi, and viruses, and that this is all autoimmunity and inflammation. But what we start to understand is that these are the most peaceful regulators of salt and water metabolism if you leave them in peace. In other words, a macrophage goes there and really wants to clean out the sodium and the water. And if you block this immune cell activity with glucocorticoid, then you will have edema. That's exactly what you would predict.
Okay.
Okay, in the sake of time, we received many more questions. So,
so just one, I will not read them, but one comment here is, this is clearly a postdoc, mm-hmm. and the questions are just brilliant. And I want nephrologists into science, so I think I should see you. with these three cards. This is all great, so we talk about that later. And the same is true here. So these are super, 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 super good questions, and I would like to spend an hour with you after the session.